Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 5th of April. What did we talk about, Matt?
Well, we talked about we looked back in anger stroke joy.
Yeah, more anger than joy.
We did a kind of Q1, quarter one audit catch up of where we were, because we agreed at the beginning of the year this is going to be a big year, and it has been.
Yeah.
And so we covered some of the big themes. But we also talked about the joy of culture and football in the last 3 months. And
yeah,
I think that, led me feeling rather cheerful.
Good. I think the first half is a bit of a tough listen, but then the second half is a good listen.
And reasons to be cheerful, part one.
Yeah. Lots of good tips for things to enjoy. So this is the Two Matts, episode 39. Please do enjoy.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, how is 2024 playing out for you so far?
Well, I think it's, if anything, worse than we thought when we did our sort of New Year's Eve predictions. Quarter one has been incident-packed, to say the least, as we thought it would be. And this is only the start. It's interesting. I was thinking about, I often call it the dentist test, which is what, when you're a journalist, I'm sure you've had this before, you get people saying, and if they clock you're a journalist, then what are people are interested, what are they? And up until very recently, it's been Brexit, Sunak, Boris Johnson. But people have started in those sort of situations, as you're having, a drill pushed into the top of your head, to ask about Trump.
Yeah.
Though I keep promising not to talk about him all the time, there's no doubt that the dominant story this year is the US presidential election. And the reason that's the case is because everything else flows from that. The future of NATO, climate change, what happens in Ukraine, what happens in Gaza, all the world trade, technology, everything. China, all these are subsections of who wins on November the 5th.
Your trip to the States, your recent trip to the States, sort of solidified. It seemed to, scared is probably too hard a word, but it certainly affirmed some of your worst fears. Didn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'd hope to find more reason for optimism. I'm not totally pessimistic. I mean, where are we now? At the end of quarter one, if you like. If the vote was tomorrow, Trump would win. I think that's true to say. And some of the polling recently has had him, kind of 5 points up. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And the news from the trials is mostly bad if you want Trump to lose. So he is going to go. I mean, he is going to be in court. The first former president is going to be in court on trial for criminal offences on April the 15th.
Yeah.
Coming up very soon. And that's a big deal.
Yeah.
But the sort of mega racketeering case in Georgia has been held up. I don't think we'll see that this side of the election. Might do. The big January the 6th election interference case is now stuck in the Supreme Court while all these conservative judges decide whether or not presidential immunity applies. The Florida classified documents case, the judge has mysteriously delayed setting a trial date.
So a lot of the super negative stuff that might have hit him, that we'd sort of priced in,
yes,
will play well for him, actually, won't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
However, so he'd win today, if yeah. but it's not being held today. The vote is being held on November the 5th, yeah. right? So we have to, you know, in the, looking back, and you mentioned when I was in the States, and I was in the States when Biden did the State of the Union, and it, my God, it was like watching the Rumble in the Jungle. I mean, it was this incredible barnstormer. You know, Trump has a lot of problems as well. He's in a massive quandary over abortion, which is a huge issue in America at the moment, because he's talking about a national ban on abortion past 15 weeks. Now, that's impossible.
Yeah. And Biden's been really clear, hasn't he?
Biden's been really clear. He will reverse
Roe Wade. Yeah.
He will reverse the overturning of Roe versus Wade, right? Yeah. Trump is massively, you know, in hock to the evangelical people who are now trying to stop IVF treatment. Wow. Contraception is next, and marriage equality will be next.
Bloody hell.
So he's got real problems with that.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's good is that Biden's starting to get a little bit more traction in battleground states, you know, the states that always decide these elections. The other sort of morsel of hope I see in the last sort of few weeks, month, is that Nikki Haley, who suspended her campaign after Super Tuesday, and you thought, well, that's the end of her. That was on March the 5th. It's really interesting. They carry on. I didn't really appreciate this before, but Trump is now the nominee. But they carry on with the primary votes. And what's fascinating is that people are coming out. Republican voters are coming out to vote for Haley.
Yeah, even though it's a lost cause. But just to say,
she's not a candidate. Yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah. She won in Arizona.
Yeah.
On March 19th, she won 17.8%. In Ohio, she won 14.4%. On March the 21st, in Florida, she won 13.9%. Now, these aren't big figures, but these are people who are registered Republicans who got up, drove to the polling station, and made a point of letting Donald Trump know.
And in that context, they are big figures, aren't they? That's quite a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, for someone who isn't...
Yeah, yeah. As a protest vote.
Going to be a candidate.
Yeah, yeah.
So he is extremely vulnerable within his own tribe. And that's, I find that very cheering.
The other good news Trump's had, which I find astonishing because I can't work out the maths on it, is the floating of Truth Social, his social network, which has pulled him out of the doodah in terms of money.
It has and it hasn't because...
You can't sell right now.
You can't sell right now.
But I suspect that the shareholders will allow him to some degree, even though it will erode the... But that business has been, 2 years old, something like that?
Yes.
And it's raised... Apparently it's made $5 million of revenue.
Yes.
It's valued at $9 billion.
And it's still not in profit.
No, of course not. It's miles away from profit.
And it's rubbish. I mean, I don't know if you've ever... you have to pay, so I've never been on it sort of myself, but I've peered over people's... what a load of rubbish. I mean, it really is sixth form website design.
If they applied the same valuation to the New European, I'd be worth $15 billion right now.
You would now be building a replica of Mar-a-Lago in Highbury Fields, right? You know, it would be a great site. You know, and we'd all go there and enjoy and sort of pay homage. So look, 7 months to go.
Yeah.
Good and bad for Biden. If he can keep doing what he did in the State of the Union in those 7 months, he'll win. The problem is he's going to be 7 months older in November. You know, and 7 months when you're 81 or whatever it is a long time. So I don't know.
Biden's running mate is not necessarily going to be Kamala Harris, is it? Is it fixed?
It's incredibly unusual.
Right.
To ditch a running mate.
Isn't she seen as a weakness?
She is. But can you imagine a Democratic convention in Chicago at which a woman of colour is ditched?
Gets knocked back,
as the vice presidential nominee.
But let's face reality. I mean, there's a, you know, again, if you're on at the bookmakers and you're asking what are the odds of Kamala Harris becoming president,
I think
second term,
an actuary would give you good odds on that.
You know, pretty even money, maybe. You know,
again, we're back in you know, the realms of what if, but I think one of the things that happened with the State of the Union was that all the theories about a brokered convention and a shift of, you know, moving Harris off, that I think they were all ended,
yeah,
for good or ill. It's a rematch,
yeah,
folks. Yeah. You know, it's
McEnroe Borg.
No one, whereas we always wanted McEnroe Borg because yeah, they were brilliant, right? It's McEnroe Borg now, right? And I mean, literally, no one in America wants this,
yeah,
apart from the parties themselves, and even they aren't sure. And I think that, just as a sort of final side note, I think one thing just to keep an eye on is third party stuff, because I noticed that Robert Kennedy Jr. has mm-hmm. named his vice presidential candidate, who's called Nicole Shanahan,
mm-hmm.
and she's the ex-wife of Sergey Brin.
Oh,
yeah.
So,
what first attracted you as a vice presidential candidate
to the
multi-billionaire?
That's very unfair. I'm sure she's a brilliant.
No,
brilliant.
I think even she would probably concede right. that. I mean, she's an attorney, and you know, she is bright and everything. But I mean, I don't.
Yeah,
I'm pointing at
the billions.
I'm pointing at RFK rather than her,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I don't think
yeah,
that was yeah. the, and she certainly wasn't his first choice either.
Right, right.
He asked Tony Robbins, could you believe?
So we should say, in case people aren't aware, Sergey Brin is the founder of Google.
Google, sorry, yeah, yes, yeah, 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 and therefore I'm not short of a few quid.
Yeah,
but here's, which I didn't realise until recently, but it's a massive fact about Robert Kennedy Jr., which is his super PAC, which is just a boring name for the organisations that they use so they can give more money to candidates than is officially allowed, is mostly, this is RFK's, is mostly funded by a businessman called Timothy Mellon, who is, drumroll, literally Trump's biggest donor.
No way.
So can you see what's going on here,
oh,
folks? Right?
I see.
I mean,
joining the dots.
He is literally a spoiler.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if RFK gets on the ballots at on enough of the swing states, that's a problem for Biden.
Yeah.
So that's just something to keep an eye on, because he is, you know, the problem with RFK is he's crazy.
Yeah.
And
just explain, by the way, his relationship to JFK.
He is the nephew of JFK,
yeah,
the son of Robert Kennedy, the original
Robert,
and brilliant Robert Kennedy.
Yeah.
But the apple really did fall fucking far from the tree here, because he's anti-vax. He is convinced that Wi-Fi gives you cancer. He is any number of mad deep state theories.
But presumably the Kennedy name still has a bit of cachet.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the problem, is that the vast majority of people haven't heard of him yet. And those that have just think of him as the next Kennedy.
Yeah.
In spite of the Kennedy family's understandable efforts very publicly to distance themselves from him. So
yeah,
the problem is that he just, you know, if he gets like 20, 30,000 votes in this district, and that, you know, suddenly these key states that Biden needs to win become
harder,
contestable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At the moment, we're not there, and he hasn't got enough money, and he's not on the ballot. But
right,
I hadn't realised until that fact crossed my radar that it's just a Trump-sponsored spoiler.
Incredible.
That's
incredible.
All it is.
All right. So, okay, well,
that's America.
The other thing that has got worse and worse and worse is the situation in Gaza.
Yeah, it's horrible.
I mean, it's beyond the pale now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And
I mean, I think a lot of people would say it was beyond the pale a lot earlier than this. But
so, I mean, it's been a horrific period.
We're talking about 32,000 and
yes,
counting dead Palestinians.
It's
almost, I think I'm right in saying, more than 50% of them children.
I mean, look, who knows what the actual figure is, but it's obviously huge and
yeah,
appalling.
Yeah.
Right? And I surely think that a common ground can be that it's bloody, horrific, horrendous. We want it to end.
Yeah. But that, I mean, that's the news, isn't it? Is that there is now global consensus that people want it to end.
Yes. And the big change, and in fact, for people who follow America's very close relationship with Israel, I mean, remember that President Harry Truman recognized Israel, I think, 10 or 11 minutes after its formation in 1948. So, I mean,
yeah,
it's like, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
And Biden is a very, very strongly Zionist president. So when he allowed the US representative on the UN Security Council to abstain on the latest ceasefire resolution on the 12th of March, so it could pass and not veto it. That was, the symbolism of that is not to be underestimated. Nor, for that matter,
the cancellation of the trip to Washington.
That was as a response to that. Yeah, yeah. But Chuck Schumer, who's the Senate Majority Leader, recently made a speech. And I mean, you know, testing the limits of interference in foreign democracies, let's be honest, you know, that it was time for Israel to have an election.
Yeah.
Well, one response to that is they've had five elections in 4 years and Gaza hasn't had an election since January 2006. But if you're looking at the sort of big issue of America and Israel, this is a very serious moment.
Well, it's a call for regime change, isn't it?
Yes, which leads to one of the many problems. And I think the thing with Gaza is that because it is, the pictures are so horrific, the reality is so horrific, it's very hard to talk about it analytically without appearing to be
callous. Yeah.
Callous, but I'm gonna try.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. No, but I can I support you in that effort?
Yeah.
Because I think it's really important that people do. Because actually, the easy thing to say is look at all these horrible pictures and look at all of that. Because that,
and you should.
And you should. And you
shouldn't avert your gaze.
But there's a sort of pornographic element to that where people wallow in the obvious catastrophe that's happened, but don't address the reality of the incredibly complex reality of what's trying to happen to get a solution of some sort, at least.
Okay, so kicking off with Netanyahu, probably the worst prime minister in Israel's history, right? I wouldn't dispute that. Likely successor, Benny Gantz. Presently a minister without portfolio in the National Unity Party. He would pursue exactly the same military strategy in Gaza.
Really?
Yes.
What, including Rafah?
Yes, he has said on Rafah, finishing the war without demilitarizing Rafah is like sending in firefighters to put out 80% of a fire.
Right.
So all I would caution people who are focusing their energies on Netanyahu is, I hear you, I get it.
Yeah.
But if your objective is peace in the Middle East, don't think that getting rid of Netanyahu
is necessarily the answer.
Well, it's
not the answer.
It may be part of it, but it's certainly not.
Yeah.
It won't change a thing overnight.
Yeah.
The second question is, what do we mean by ceasefire? Because ceasefire is a term of art, and it's come to mean about 10 different things. So, at minimum, I think all but the most crazed hawks could agree that surely we can have a humanitarian truce where aid can be got in urgently. We can move forward with hostage release and there can be some respite from the fighting. And you remember in November there was a 6-day truce.
Yeah.
And actually it was hoped that it would last a lot longer and then it didn't. It fell apart. But you know, a humanitarian truce could last quite a long time. But some people, when they say ceasefire, actually mean Israel unilaterally stopping its actions.
Yeah.
And that's never going to work as a proposition. I mean, that actually won't command the support of the US or the UK or many other.
Yeah.
Because it was Hamas that broke the ceasefire in the first place. And it's very hard for non-Israelis to understand how big a deal October the 7th was, how traumatized the Israeli psyche is.
Mm-hmm.
And the consequence of October the 7th for Israelis, whatever anyone else in the world, including whoever is in the Oval Office, thinks, is that Israel will never do business with Hamas, ever. Yeah.
But I mean, imagine if, you know, I can't put myself in the position of an Israeli citizen, and especially not one that suffered the murder of someone you know or love at the hands of terrorists. I can't do that. But at the same token, I can't put myself in the position of those, you know, I don't want to get too emotive about it, but those pictures of fathers holding their dead babies above their heads in Palestine.
No.
You know, and the cycle goes on and on and on.
And it's more than this cycle, because it is certainly true that, you know, there's been a cycle of Israeli-Arab conflict since the formation of the state and before.
Yeah.
But what's particularly appalling and different and difficult about this particular chapter is that when Hamas launched its attack, it understood what was going to happen because it had set the battlefield in advance to ensure that as many of its own civilians as possible would be killed. I mean, one of the interesting factoids to emerge from this is that the Israelis reckoned before the conflict that it was about 100 miles of tunnel underneath the strip. They've now reached about 500, 500 miles of tunnels, which are occupied, by the way, by Hamas people, not by civilians.
Yeah.
They've packed every single weapons and military infrastructural area they have with civilians, you know. And this means that it's almost impossible to fight them in a way that is not going to
be holistically destructive,
which it has been. Now, the orthodox view is it's not working. Well, hold on. You know, most estimates say that about 13,000 of the roughly 30,000 Hamas paramilitary troops have died. Three quarters of Hamas's battalions have been rendered ineffective. Two of the five brigade commanders and 19 of the 24 battalion commanders are out of action. And Israel is reckoned to have damaged or made inoperable about 40% of the tunnels. So they are making progress.
Yeah.
Now, there are 5,000 to 8,000 Hamas fighters in Rafah, which is why your original question is the key.
Yeah.
You see, I don't think Israel cares at all what the world thinks. I think
that's self-evident, to be honest.
Yeah, but I think it's also intrinsic to Israel. Yeah. You know, that Israel was founded as a state which was, okay, right, we get it. You don't want us to assimilate into your countries. Mm. You don't want us in Europe. So we're going to have to found a Jewish state in the Middle East.
Yes.
We live in countries where PR, for want of a better word, is really important. I mean, you know, one of the things that was hideous about Brexit was the knowledge that everyone around the world thought we were a bunch of wankers, right?
Yeah.
Israel is Millwall. Mm. Everyone hates us and we don't care. Yeah. Now, the only variable in any of that that makes any difference is, would an American president turn off the tap?
Yeah.
And I don't believe that Biden, who is in the end...
And the tap being...
Money.
And military support as well.
Money of all sorts. You know, money for military aid, money, you know. Yeah, yeah. If there was a US president that turned off the tap, then that might have an impact. But I don't think that Chuck Schumer standing up and saying you need a new prime minister is the way to change Israeli hearts and minds. And the other point about all this, which I think is, again, it's very unwelcome to people, but it is just the case, is that this is only one conflict in a big regional conflict. You know, Iran, the involvement of the Houthis, the role of the Wagner group in training Hamas, it's entirely framed as, at the moment, as bad Israel doing bad things. And that's totally understandable because of the horrific images with which we're bombarded every day. But it's only one framing. And in the end, it's not enough because the likely scenario, to be honest with you, is that this is going to escalate, and not in terms of in Gaza, but to other fronts.
And that's what's terrifying.
Yes.
Even more terrifying.
But I mean, Israel being bad. That's Iran.
Yes.
Not wanting the Abraham Accords to work and Saudi Arabia to form an alliance with Israel. Now, that all this sounds so bloodless and cold.
Look, in the spirit of bloodless cynicism, it feels almost miraculous that that hasn't happened yet.
Yes. You know,
it's astonishing, actually, that it hasn't spread further.
He's had a lot of flack during this, but Antony Blinken, the American Secretary of State, has spent the last few months on a plane to all of these capitals trying to stop exactly this.
Yeah.
But the bit that I find most depressing, and I don't have anything approaching an answer to, is that the two things people say in this very heated debate and very heated argument, which has spread all over the world and there have been marches all over the world, is ceasefire now, well, we've talked about that, and a two-state solution. Great. But the point of October the 7th was to make a two-state solution impossible.
Impossible, yeah.
Because Hamas doesn't want a two-state solution. I remember our first discussion about this, we talked about the need for a regional group to take over Gaza when it was over.
Yeah.
And I think even more than that, Israel needs help further down the line, and I mean years down the line, in finding partners to talk to.
Yeah, and to take some of the pressure off. But they shoulder that burden themselves, don't they? Saying it's like, it's our responsibility to make Palestine work. It's our responsibility, you know, for better or worse, you know, that they fence it in, they make conditions terrible. You know, now they're laying waste to it, you know. It does seem that if we live in a community of nations, that there should be more involvement, meaningful involvement in the future of that nation that's laid waste, than just saying, well, ultimately, Israel, it's up to you.
That's
the
problem.
Ultimately, it's up to you. Well, it can't be left like that. It can't be up to Israel, you know.
I mean, you've got a ridiculous situation now, haven't you, where actually there are only two countries that are really talking about it. One is America and one is Israel, right?
Yeah.
So America is giving Israel bombs and military funding and building a pier to put humanitarian aid into Gaza.
It's madness.
Now, that really is madness. Yeah. And I think that if in the next quarter of this year, I could hope for anything, it would be for genuinely multinational, genuinely regional projects to possibly involving boots on the ground, to be honest, to start to talk about, okay, you know, it can't be Hamas, so what? You know, who is there? Who can we build up? Who can we help? Who can we finance to give the Israelis good faith partners to talk with?
I completely agree with you on that. Listen, just 2 minutes before we move on to something happier in the second half. But the other kind of chronic nightmare situation, which has slipped under the news agenda increasingly, is Ukraine still, you know?
It's...
Do you remember the time when it was all you could read about? It was all you could see? I mean, it's still the same situation, but it's less and less on our national agenda now.
I think that we live in an attention deficit society.
Don't we just?
And essentially Gaza displaced Ukraine in the international gaze, as it were.
Yeah.
What's so fascinating is, to take Putin for a second, how volatile his position is, because last year we had the Prigozhin Wagner group coup, and then everyone said he's always fragile, Putin, and then Prigozhin fell out of the sky, and that was
accidentally. Can happen to anybody.
Terrible accident.
Yeah,
I'm sure Putin was very shocked when he heard. He said, "I thought that was tomorrow." then we had, and I think you know. Again, to your point, you know, how quickly it's forgotten, Alexei Navalny dying on the 16th of February. That's already draining.
Isn't it amazing? It is worth just reflecting for a second. That was such an astonishing event. We all thought this is a real moment in time. And of course it still is. But the pace that we now collectively move on these seismic stories is it just extraordinary.
It's a tweet.
Yeah.
You know? Mid-March, Putin wins a fifth term.
Yeah.
Surprise. Invulnerable.
Incredible. Another shock.
And then, on the 22nd, there's this unspeakable attack in Moscow.
Unbelievably awful,
ISIS-K, at least 139 killed. Sidebar, worth remembering, because sometimes people, in a slightly Islamophobic way, assume that they're all the same. Yeah. No. Yeah. ISIS-K and Hamas hate each other.
Yeah.
They hate each other.
And they hate the Taliban.
And so I saw a sort of brief surge of, this is the next front. No, it's different. This is a different thing. The Islamic State has a specific beef with Putin, and that's what this is about.
Yeah.
But obviously Putin's sell to his country is, you know, he is Mr. Security, he is Mr. I stamp out all disorder. So, you know, for what it's worth, this March was not a great month.
I mean, that was an astonishing attack.
Incredible.
That those four people could just wander through that concert hall.
I find it...
And get away, and then get captured.
And then horribly tortured.
Honestly, what they did... it really stretched my humanity. Battered faces in court, I kind of thought, good, but, you know.
This is where Putin is so, I was going to say smart, but that's the wrong word to use. He's cunning. is that he knows that the opportunity cost of revealing the brutality of his methods is outweighed by the visceral response, which is, yeah, if you kill 139 people and...
I mean, unfortunately, I saw some of the video, which was all over Twitter when it first...
It was
again, you know, what an age we live in where that kind of stuff is almost live streamed, you know.
But it's we've said it many times on the podcast, which is never underestimate the power of belief.
Yeah.
You know, we talk a lot about money, which is important, and we talk a lot about the power of institutions. But these are people who are driven by belief. And one of the great errors, I think, of our times is believing that everyone is like us.
Yeah. I'm with John Lennon on it. Imagine no religion. You know, what a wonderful world.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, just a side note to that. One of the things that I'm pretty shocked by is how, this sounds silly, but religion is making a comeback.
Mm.
So there's a lot of... This is, you see this in like Jordan Peterson's next book is We Who Wrestle With God or something like that. Through my letterbox came Marilyn Robinson's new book about Genesis. And I thought what's happening here is that there's this new, in this new endless quest for meaning, there are people saying, to paraphrase, okay, you don't have to believe in God, but religion's kind of cool.
Mm.
Is it?
Yeah. Let's leave that question hanging
in the air. Exactly.
And we'll come back to some genuinely cool stuff because I want to ask you about some cultural highlights.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So
well, on that, that's a very happy. That's a my happy place.
See you after a very short break, folks. Thank you. This podcast is brought to you, as ever, by the New European Newspaper, and we've got a great offer for you. Do you like the New European Newspaper, Matt?
Well, I like working for it, and I enjoy reading it. So it's a double thumbs up from me.
So you're already a subscriber. So this
I actually am. Yeah.
This is of no interest to you because you'll feel like you're missing out.
No, but
it's a great offer.
I find it validating.
Okay. Well, listen, if you're not a subscriber, you really should be because you'll be supporting fantastic independent journalism that you'll actually enjoy getting posted through your letterbox every week. And as an exclusive offer for listeners of the Two Mats podcast, we've got free signed copies of James O'Brien's hardback book, which is a brilliant book, isn't
it? Great book. The book.
How They Broke Britain, and that's worth £20. And you can get that by subscribing for as little as £1 a week for all of our digital stuff. But if, like me, you love getting your hands on a physical newspaper every single week, you can get that delivered to your door for just an extra £1 a week, and that's a saving of around 80% on the cost of what you'd pay at the newsstand. So please do the right thing, subscribe to The New European, go to thenewEuropean.co.uk/2Matts, that's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, and tell them we sent you.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So very, very angsty, depressing first half.
Yeah, but, sorry about that, folks.
But there's been some really great cultural stuff this year so far. Can we relive some of those moments?
Well, one that we both saw was Sarah Snooking, The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Amazing.
Wasn't that fantastic?
Is it? It's not still on, is it?
I think it's on a little while longer.
Is it?
Until May,
It's probably almost impossible to get a ticket. But, I mean, you've been to more things than I have. I've been to lots of things. But that's one of the most extraordinary performances I've ever seen. That.
Very few things you go to, you think that it would have been a real tragedy if you hadn't seen it.
Yeah, and that's really one of them. Missed that,
right?
You know, like seeing Jerusalem, or
100%.
You know, I saw Network with Bryan Cranston in New York.
Wasn't that great?
Amazing.
I saw it in London.
And I don't know if they had the same setup, but
it
they had like a sort of cafe. I can't remember exactly what it was, like a restaurant or the office cafeteria,
right.
You could pay to be on stage.
Oh, and you were on stage.
So we were sitting there, and Bryan Cranston was walked past and have a cocktail.
It was amazing,
but that Sarah Snook thing was—it was up there with that. Definitely.
It was. I mean, a lot of my cultural. I mean, normally I'm a movie fanatic, but another two plays, two productions of Enemy of the People.
Yeah.
One with Matt Smith, former Doctor Who, which is ending in May, I think, the Duke of York's Theatre, and a very much an update of modernization of the classic account of a local. Civic activist Thomas Stockman, who finds that the spa water is contaminated, so it speaks to the environment and populism and how the forces of media and power resist the truth and science. And then I saw, when I was in New York, I saw good old Kendall Roy, Jeremy Strong, paying the part in a much more traditional costume setting with Christopher from the Sopranos, Michael Imperioli as his brother the mayor, and I wasn't there at this particular performance, but there was one in the New York one where either Extinction Rebellion or Just Stop Oil, I'm not sure which one, campaigner kind of interrupted the proceedings, and really to their credit, Jeremy Strong and Michael Imperioli kept going in character,
brilliant,
saying let him have his say.
No way.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how far it got.
Yeah.
But that's...
That's class.
That's the point.
Yeah.
You know, that's why this play is having a moment, is because it's about...
Yeah.
You know, the tensions of populism and lies and truth and post-truth. And I thought that was...
And that's what Brian Cox always slagged Jeremy Strong off for, wasn't it? Was that
being
in character and never coming out.
I mean, there it was.
Fantastic. Now, listen, let me mention... You got another play you wanted to say?
Nope.
Wrote a book review for the New Europeans Cultural Newsletter.
Which went out on last Friday.
Last Friday.
Yeah.
In which you described this book, which I'd like you to talk about, as being... similar to, but better than, Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe.
Yes.
Which took me aback.
Well, first of all, I said, you know, I'm a huge fan of Bonfire of the Vanities. So yeah. this was not written lightly. Caledonian Road is a new novel by Andrew O'Hagan, out on April the 4th. And it is a big book like Bonfire of the Vanities. And it's a State of the Nation book. And it's set just after the end of the pandemic, and it concerns its main character is an intellectual, art historian, podcaster, and man about town called Campbell Flynn, who is going through a kind of crisis over money. His sense suddenly that he is vulnerable culturally because times are changing, and what his place in the world is. And he's writing a self-help book about male identity called Why Do Men Weep in Cars, which I like very much.
Brilliant title.
But he arranges to have a actor pretend to be the author with, as they say, hilarious consequences. But that doesn't do justice to the book, because what it is, it contains multitudes. I mean, the Campbell Flynn character is only the start of this. O'Hagan creates this enormous world of, you know, human trafficking and the drug trade and dodgy Tory businessmen and dodgy Labour peers and Russian oligarchs. And it sort of, it's teeming with life.
Yeah. And he's such a great writer.
And it's a book he's been working on for a while. Mm. And therefore it was genuinely, you know, the word is overused, but it was eagerly awaited.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like him very much as a writer and as a person, but also when I read it, I was really excited because I thought, this is a book we're going to be talking about for a long time.
Great
because
stuff.
It captures so many of the things that are talked about in podcasts and in newspaper articles and things, but in a fictional setting. Yeah, yeah. And it's very hard to do that without seeming too didactic, but he has that knack.
Brilliant. Andrew works for the London Review of Books.
He does. He's a great essayist.
I'm very jealous of that and wish he'd write for us sometime.
Yes. I mean, he is. I also think of him as being very much in the kind of 1960s tradition of, you know, the Norman Mailers and the Joan Didions and the Gay Talaises, yeah, in that he can kind of do it all. You know, he can do the novels and indeed Tom Wolfe, you know, he can do the novels, but he also writes wonderful long read journalistic pieces, and funnily enough, last year he produced a play at Edinburgh about Truman Capote.
Oh yeah,
you know, so he's
that same vein. Yeah,
he's just multi-talented.
Let me give you a tip,
please.
I'm coming late to it as ever, but it's prompted by, I think it's new to Netflix, newish anyway. It's a documentary called American Symphony, by a musician in the United States who I had never heard of, but is very famous in the States. He used to be Stephen Colbert's kind of late night show band leader.
Oh, right.
A man called John Batiste. And he's won loads of Grammys. He's won an Oscar. He's beautiful, kind of somewhere between John Legend and Lenny Kravitz, you know, and an amazing. He plays one of these, do you know what a melodica is?
No.
So it's like a kid's piano that you kind of blow into. It's got two octaves, and it makes a harmonica and a kind of keyboard, and he plays that down the street. And fantastic guy. I mean, really from New Orleans, really beautiful kind of personality and character. But that, so I was absorbed by that, and I bought his album called World Music Radio, which is fantastic.
Okay.
Best of all, I was led to his partner, who is in the documentary, called Suleika Jouad, and Suleika was diagnosed with leukemia.
Oh, wow.
And survived leukemia. And I think about 3 years ago, so as I say, I'm late to this bit, wrote one of the best books I've ever read about her battle through leukemia, but then almost even the bigger battle to refine herself, having survived.
Yes, of course.
What was a disease that she was given, I think, 35% chance of survival.
Right, so...
But she goes through this, she tells this extraordinary story. It's like, it feels like a road trip, like almost like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, but for surviving cancer and then coming through the other end of it. And honestly, I recommend it. It's called Between Two Kingdoms.
Fascinating.
And it is a beautifully told story about what it's like to face death, face cancer, go through the agony of the treatment, but what happens around the people you love, how you move through life, and then how you reinvent yourself on the other side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's extraordinary.
You know, that's an anecdote that or an example of something that I think is undervalued, which is, it's become orthodox now to whinge about streaming, right? And say, it's not as good as it used to be, right? Which may be true. But the upside of streaming is exactly what you just described, which is you find a gem. And that leads you to a book.
Yeah, yeah.
And the truth is that wasn't the case
in
the pre-streaming world.
That's right.
You know,
you couldn't make the links like,
because now I'm going to go and watch that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hope, I'm probably go off and order the book on Amazon. And that's where streaming really does have the edge on linear TV.
Yeah.
And people should stop moaning about it. And that's my message to the nation.
Very good. The other cultural highlight, I would say, is the football season so far. And I know this isn't at the heart of
your
being.
There's nothing you can tell me that I don't know already.
But the Premier League this year so far has just been incredible. And I think the title race...
Some of the greatest games ever, you've said.
50% of the audience have switched off now.
No,
but the
I
other
don't think
50%
so.
Are tuned in. I went to see Liverpool play Manchester City at Anfield a couple of weeks ago. And it was the most extraordinary witnessing of any high level sport I've ever seen in my life. The level these people are playing at now is just incredible. And the drama of 60,000 people at Anfield, all absolutely combusting with passion at what's being played out in front of them for 90 minutes is, I don't think there's anything that can touch it if you're into it. You know?
I tell you what I think about, because as you know, my knowledge of football is to say the least limited, but
You know more than you let on, as all good players would play.
And player is the word.
Yeah.
I look at it, and my sons are very much into it, and I think this is not a broken society.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
That's nice. No, it does.
Because I look on the passion that people have for their teams.
Yeah.
And I look on the pictures on my social media of people with their kids or their mates at games, and I watch the clips of the fans, and I think, no, you know, as much as I'm, you know, reading the latest Jonathan Haidt book about how we're all living in segregated, atomized misery, we're not.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, we're not. You know, and the success of sport, and you know, the one bit of football that I thought has been, you know, socially so fascinating is women's football is now everywhere.
Can I boast?
Please.
My daughter,
your brilliant daughter.
My daughter made her debut for the Millwall women's first team. Came off the bench for 15 minutes. In a friendly, came off the bench for 15 minutes.
Hey, mate, that's
performed
amazing.
Performed well. A couple of chances.
Well done, well. Sky.
Yeah, so she's... But you're right, you know, that's...
It's just part of...
It's fantastic how it's being taken seriously. It's getting broadcast on television, rugby, athletics, football, you know.
And I hadn't appreciated until that recent documentary, Copper 71.
Yeah, amazing.
Right, but I hadn't realised that they did it, this World Cup, right? And then the authorities said, no, you can't do that anymore.
I thought that
there'd been a steady rise, which expected. No.
It was outlawed, basically, by the FA.
We're not having this. Extraordinary story. When you think now of how... integral to sort of a sense of national identity the Lionesses are. They're really there. You know, they're really at the heart of it.
Yeah.
The idea that not that long ago, people were saying you can't do that.
It was illicit. Incredible.
Should we, before we bid a farewell to an anxious nation, should we just briefly say... three cheers for the ITV drama department.
Oh.
For
yes.
Both Mr. Bates versus the post office, which within 9 days had led to a change of legislation or announcement.
Amazing.
Of changes. And then the wonderful breathtaking about the COVID scandal.
There's more to come, I think, isn't there?
They're now making one on the infected blood scandal.
Good for that. They're working, basically, what they've done very smartly is work through all of the balls that this government and previous have dropped.
Scandal.
And said, here, look at this. Look at this.
I hope they keep going.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there will be more scandals to uncover.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, but that's the power of cult. You know, when people talk about culture as being siloed, I always think of things like this.
Yeah.
And no, it's not siloed, actually.
Well, when you said about, you know, that these are encouraging signs and
very.
That, you know, we're not broken as a people.
No.
I think it's funny. Sometimes you think that the things that are the real indicators of how we are as a society, you know, our politics and our government and our media and all of this business. Actually, when you look at the things that last and are sustainable and that people are carried along with their whole lives, it's not that. It's the things that it's food and it's sport and it's culture and it's movies and books.
Friendship. What they bring.
It's all those good things.
Yes,
know?
It is. And it's incredibly important without being, you know, Pollyanna-ish. To reassert these things and to say no, these things matter, and we have them and we're good at them in this country, by the way,
you know,
which is why I'm glad to see the BBC is looking at its funding thing, which is, you know, not the most interesting point to make, but it's true, because, you know, a world without the BBC, for all its flaws that people endlessly draw attention to, would be stupid. You know, it would just be that. That would be a triumph.
Can you imagine
Phyllis
tossing the BBC out?
Well, I mean, not only can I imagine it, but I hear Conservative politicians on the regs saying you need to get rid of it.
Again, like we were talking in last week in a podcast, people talking in pure self-interest and without an with a total absence of common sense altruism.
I mean, that is going to. I mean, I don't think with a under a Labour government, which is more likely than not, to say the least, it's a likely thing to happen.
Yeah,
but the BBC is going to need a sort of a vigilante group around it in the decades to come, because as people stop owning televisions in the way that they used to, and the TV license has to go, and younger people say, well, hang on a minute, I pay for Netflix, and you know, it will become harder to defend, but more necessary to defend.
Yeah,
because it is literally one of the most important forms of soft power this country has.
Fantastic. And that's a
thumbs
great
up for culture. It hasn't been, I mean, you know, it's always important to say, as bad as things have got, you know, they haven't all been bad.
Well, could we get a culture secretary that knows something about it?
Yes.
Be a good idea, wouldn't it? So anyway, that was a great conversation. Thank you for that, Matt. Yeah.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed it, if you didn't enjoy it, if you have something to say, if you got a great cultural tip for us, if you disagree with anything we said in the first half, please get your questions and any feedback into the two Matts, that's the number two, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen to us on Spotify, you can message us there very easily. And that's what Alison did, who says, whenever Matt Kay begins to speak, for a split second, I think it's Stephen Tompkinson. Really? Do I ever?
I've never experienced that, but I will now I will listen with fresh ears.
Have they ever been in the same room? I don't think we have, no.
No.
Okay. Well, drop the dead donkeys on tour if you want the real deal, apparently.
I think we should phone up Tompkinson and ask him what he thinks.
Well, why don't we just get Tompkinson to do this for a week and see if anyone notices?
Yeah, see if he finds it.
Just rant angrily.
Well, no, see if he finds it easy to rant angrily about Brexit. It's not easy, you know.
Our Q&A will return next Sunday, so look out for that one, folks. And please remember our subscription offer. If you like this podcast, I promise you will love the New European newspaper. Just go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. There's a link in the show notes, and you can get the newspaper delivered to your door for around £2 a week. That's pretty good, isn't it?
Bargain.
Thank you, as ever, to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, with support from Ollie Peart. And until next week...
It's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.